This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Tech Talk, made possible by TM1.
It's Fun Friday. My name is Jeff Sandhu. Refrigeration is a topic we come back to frequently on MSP, mostly because Matt Armitage can't actually cope with the tropical climate he chose to live in with. Today, we take a look at solutions to refreeze the Arctic and how our addiction to cold air could be warming the planet. So Matt, you have an obsession with being cold. So we know when you complain about the temperature in the recording studios, it is really, really cold.
Well, hey, Jeff. I mean, yeah, of course, when I first came to Malaysia all those years ago, it wasn't as hot as it is now. In fact, I remember when I first came here, there was snow on the ground and the taxi driver at the airport told me not to feed the polar bears.
I think you're remembering a fever dream.
All youth is a fever dream. You wake up one morning and there's just a stagnant eternity ahead of you. But you've got that to look forward to if you aren't burned up in the fiery hell that is climate change first.
Nice link from hopelessness to eternal damnation.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was quite pleased with that one. But it's true. I do find Malaysia's climate increasingly hard to cope with. Now, I could do the solid research-based thing and look up temperature and rainfall charts over the past 20 years and compare them to similar records over the past couple of hundred years. But who has time for anything that's not on the first page of a Google search?
Certainly not you.
Double definitely not me. But also because I know a lot of the problem is with me and changes in the way that I react to heat, which, you know, I'm not going to bore people with.
Because you're bald and overweight and very, very pale.
As I said, boring reasons that don't need to be discussed on air. In fact, I woke up with a start yesterday morning because the air conditioning in my bedroom suddenly clicked off. Mm. Now, there are two reasons I panic when that happens. Firstly, because it's a bit of a PTSD light trigger because I was once in a landslide in the middle of the night and that was signaled by a power cut. Mm. But secondly, because I am the angriest person in the world if I sleep in the heat. I mean, honestly, a sleep-deprived me is much nicer than an overheated me, which should give you some indication as to how mean I get without climate control. Mm. In the end, it turned out that I had accidentally shut the off timer by mistake when I was groping around for the controller in the dark in the middle of the night. So obviously I just turned it back on and went back to sleep.
So given the quality of that anecdote, I'm guessing that you're still sleep deprived?
Maybe, or maybe I'm just swallowing the meanness. I wouldn't suggest that you drink any of the liquids at your desk, however. The anecdote that thrilled you so much was actually to illustrate our addiction to and our dependence on air conditioning.
Is it as interesting as the podcast about sand?
Not quite, but the two are actually connected. Geek Squats listeners may remember that a couple of months ago I recommended an episode of 99% Invisible about sand and its role in creating the concrete empires of our world. And Jeff, after finally listening to it, the episode's called Built on Sand, acknowledged how interesting that episode actually was.
So I thought it was one of those slow burner, you know, towards the end of the point, it's going to make sense. But actually, within the first minute itself, it got me hooked.
Yeah, I know. It's just gripping. But air conditioning systems are kind of a byproduct of that concrete and sand world. I've been following the paradox of our increased use of air conditioning as the world warms and the impact that the air conditioning is actually having on that warming. So it becomes this feedback loop or downward spiral that people are always talking about. The more we use air conditioning, the worse the problems become and the more we need to use it. This may not apply to listeners outside Malaysia so much, but, you know, when was the last time you went a full day without using air conditioning or fans? The chances are, if you did, it probably wasn't here in Malaysia or it certainly wasn't by choice. And that mechanism our way of life is built on, this electricity generated at remote power stations, this is an incredibly fragile way to live.
Like the power cuts across New York on one of the hottest weekends of the year.
Well, yeah, the further irony that our energy grids, like our home appliances, aren't actually built for extremes. They tend to fail when they need it the most, whether it be energy for cooling or for heating. The last time I was in UK, there was a heat wave. Mm. In other words, the temperatures and humidity reached the levels that are the day-to-day norm here in Malaysia. But of course, none of the other infrastructure there is the same as it is here. So the tarmac on the roads was melting because it's designed to be hardy at low temperatures. The chillers, fridges and freezers in the supermarkets and in people's houses were breaking down because they're rated to a lower top temperature than the machines that we use out in the tropics.
And people's homes are geared towards staying warm rather than being cool.
Yeah, building regulations make the homes heat sinks, you know, very few people bother with ceiling fans, let alone air conditioning for the 3 days a year that you don't need an umbrella or to wear a bearskin. But that's when you see how dependent we are, because in those conditions, everything stops. Literally nothing functions. This year, during another heat wave in the UK, I think the power load actually affected the rail network. Buildings were sucking up power for climate control, and the spikes, just like in New York, required that parts of the network be powered down or they would risk burning out all of the network gubbins. And that part of the network that they shut down was actually the train network ferrying commuters and travellers around the country.
So that's what happened in New York this summer.
Yeah, parts of Brooklyn and Queens were disconnected because the provider, Con Edison, was afraid that demand would cause the grid to collapse. Mm. Better to inconvenience 100,000 odd people in those neighborhoods than to risk a collapse that could have cut off supplies to hundreds and hundreds of thousands for days at a time. At least, you know, that was their reasoning, because there are no best decisions in these situations. There are only the least bad ones because, you know, it's not only about comfort.
And the health outcomes?
Well, yeah, extreme heat and, of course, cold has impacts on the most vulnerable people in society, the young, the old and the sick. And we know that death rates spike during heat waves, most noticeably amongst the groups that don't have access to adequate cooling or heating. Mm. Which is a lot to think about when you turn on the AC above the sofa as you settle in to watch Netflix. And I'm certainly no paragon of virtue here. In fact, I'm probably one of the worst and most obvious repeat offenders.
In terms of cranking it up?
I mean, I'm so dependent on them at home. If I'm moving between different rooms, I leave the AC running in each room. Because our cat is getting older, I'll sometimes leave one running wherever he happens to be. Mm. So as long as I'm in the house, my wife's not so bad, but as long as I'm in the house, at least one AC will be running 24/7. Wow. And right now, because of the haze, we have at least two air filters running as well. At night, I also have a small water-powered AC unit that blows on my face while I sleep. And I'll be honest, you know, when I hit those on switches, I'm not thinking about the load on the grid that I'm contributing to. I'm just thinking about getting clean air into my lungs and not having my brain swell.
So why are we talking about AC during a show about the Arctic?
Well, because things are very much linked. As I said, you know, in our quest to stay cool, we're committing ourselves to behaviours that are causing other parts of the world to heat up. And in the case of the Arctic and many of our glaciers, to actually physically melt. And we underestimate the amount of power that these units and systems consume. In one Guardian piece I referenced, AC accounted for almost half the energy consumption in Beijing during a heat wave last year, 50%. And the buildings themselves are actually partly to blame.
So it's a lack of geoengineering.
Well, definitely over-engineering of one sort or another. You know, we build in concrete and glass because it's fast, it's cheap, and we think it looks good. We've stopped designing so much for the local climate. We treat cooling and engineering as problems to be fixed with technology, not as architectural requirements.
And people didn't look very comfortable in Game of Thrones.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about the way things were in the past, you know, if you think of that show as Europe in the Middle Ages, Northern Europe had somehow forgotten everything it learned from the Romans, Greeks, Egyptians, Moors, and pretty much every other civilization. Roman villas had air conditioning based on the evaporative cooling principle. It was also widespread in ancient Egypt. But the key was building for the climate, to use building materials that suit the place you're building in, not to look at them as boxes to be made as cheaply as possible and cram them full of electric-powered gadgets to solve these architectural or design problems. And this is the weird thing. When the apocalypse eventually comes, caves may actually be a more comfortable and enticing proposition to live in than our actual homes are.
All right, when we come back, get ready with those hats and gloves as MSP reports from the Arctic. We'll be right back, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to Tech Talk, made possible by TM1.
Banish feudal mentality. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Tech Talk, made possible by TM1.
And we're back, and this is MSP. My name is Jeff Sander, together with Matt Armitage. Matt wanted me to put all kinds of chilly sound effects into this half of the show and pretend it was recorded on a location in Greenland. I've also warned him that if he blows into his microphone and pretends it's the wind, he'll be looking for a new producer. So Matt, don't tell me you want to take all the air conditioning units we currently own and power them up into the Arctic?
You really do spoil all my fun, don't you? No, as much as I would love to do that as a piece of theatre or performance art, no, you know, even I'm not that daft. No, these are actual plans by scientists, by real actual scientists.
Well, what's the thinking behind it?
Well, anyone who isn't keen on climate science or is living in denial should probably switch off the show now. This isn't a trigger warning. I'm just not interested in having these discussions anymore. If you don't believe that human activity is warming the planet, you're welcome to your opinion, but I'm not going to waste any more time on it. But as we have the evidence for, losing these climate buffers creates all kinds of knock-on effects.
Like the rising sea levels, water temperature changes?
Well, currents are affected, which also changes the habitats and feeding grounds of marine life. It's also highly likely that it leads to the kind of extreme weather events we're seeing more frequently. Drought, devastating hurricanes, wildfires, heat waves, extreme interseasonal variations, which of course can ruin farm crops and disrupt food supplies. We also overlook the role that glaciers and the poles play because they have a function that's a bit like a mirror. They reflect the sun's radiation and they help to cool the planet. And as they melt, not only is that radiation not reflected, the exposed and dark land and water actually absorb more of that energy. So you lose one positive and you actually replace it with multiple negatives.
So people talk about extinction level events. Is that what we're heading for?
Well, I wanted to talk more about solutions and science and technology, but we do have this habit of thinking that we're an important species. We're not. We just happen to be the dominant one. And I don't think there's any doubt that the planet will still be here in a few million years. But it's a mistake to think that the planet cares about us. Our lifespans, even our species, occupy little more than a fraction in the Earth's life cycle. So if hurricanes and earthquakes and supervolcanoes are what it takes to restore some sort of equilibrium, or for the planet to move to a new equilibrium, that's exactly what it's going to do, irrespective of what we do or say. So really, it's just the cats that I feel bad for.
We're definitely not going there.
That's the next 5 minutes of material out of the window then. Well, that leaves me with nothing but science.
Oh, finally.
Well, okay, geoengineering, we mentioned quickly before the break, but it's something we often talk about, but more in relation to space travel, the kind of extensive terraforming we would need in order for Matt Damon and Elon Musk to share a community garden on Mars, for example. But some geoengineering projects are relatively straightforward. Painting the roofs white in city to reflect sunlight, again, just like the surface of Arctic snow, and repainting and rewilding forest lands and urban areas. These are all straightforward things we can do. But this kind of geoengineering, this idea of directly intervening to influence the climate, it's not supported by all the stakeholders in the climate science field.
Because of the risk?
Well, no, the risks are there, but we'll discuss those in relation to each example. But we're not trying to build a Dyson sphere and reflect the sun's cosmic rays into space. For one thing, if we get the angle wrong, life may get very hot for the Mars colonists out tending their potatoes. They might feel like ants under a microscope. But some scientists seem to be worried about the precedent that geoengineering sets, that it says we can pollute and emit as much as we like, and that science and technology will find ways to mitigate those risks.
But isn't that what they're doing?
Well, The New Scientist quotes Cecilia Bitz, a sea ice physicist at the University of Seattle, Washington. And I'll be honest, I didn't know that sea ice physicist was actually a thing. But the number of things that haven't occurred to me and make sense is probably pretty much limitless. And it certainly makes sense that sea ice has physical properties to research and better understand. Anyway, Professor Bitz points out that we're not really doing that much to limit our carbon emissions anyway.
Most people are like you. They just hit the aircon switch.
See, I told you that the stories are actually linked. So the question is still, what can we do? One of the ideas that's being put forward in a New Scientist piece called Refreeze the Arctic by Rowan Hooper is a process being pioneered by an astrophysicist. Again, somebody you don't normally think of in the climate field. An astrophysicist called Stephen Desch at Arizona State University. And his approach is actually quite low tech, but enormous in scale. He proposes simply pumping seawater onto ice during the winter. It'll freeze, it will start to thicken the existing ice and function a bit like the process of land reclamation by extending the coverage of the ice sheet, literally inch by inch.
I get the spraying water bit, but how would you do it? Ships that spray water onto the ice?
Well, Desch realizes that scale is the key to his approach. Having a few ships out there is unlikely to do much except waste people's time. He wants to build floating pump stations powered by windmills. A lot of them.
How many?
Well, he calculates about 10 million. And at the moment, his trials have all been lab-based. So creating unmanned stations, 10 million unmanned stations that will be robust enough to live and work at sea in such a hostile environment, obviously is still unproven. And then there's the cost. Some estimates put the cost at around $500 billion, US dollars, which I imagine would have world leaders like Donald Trump turning orange with anger under the artificial lights. But I have to admit, I do love the kind of steampunk flavor of this. I mean, imagine an ocean of windmills and mechanical pumps. And if it does happen, I guess you'd want Peter Jackson to be the one making the documentary.
And that's radical in scale rather than science. Are there any approaches that are pushing the technology side?
Well, the strange thing is we've always had the tools to combat the climate crisis, but we've never had the will. And the same goes with the science. It's not so much that we're expecting someone to invent a magic switch or build an app to set the thermostat on the world's molten core to frost over. So really, all of these examples are using ingenious ways to apply our existing knowledge. I can only say ingenious like Inspector Clouseau. Remember, I mentioned painting roofs as a good cooling method earlier.
Yeah, you want to paint the Arctic. Wouldn't that be more work than building 10 million windmills?
Yeah, but you don't physically have to paint it. So Leslie Field, an engineer at Stanford University, is exploring the option of dropping billions of silicon microbeads across the region. They're incredibly fine. They're actually more like sand. So it's more of a dusting the ice with powder. Tests on a frozen lake in Alaska have had promising results. They've slowed the melt because it gives fresh young ice, which actually has a name, it's called albedo. It gives it a chance to recover. And because it increases the reflectiveness, it reduces its susceptibility to melting.
But that word microbeads, it's a little bit of a red flag, though.
Well, yeah, it's one of those words you hear and start to think twice about with all the attention on plastic pollution. You know, microbeads don't have a great reputation. Certainly no one knows what the environmental impact of millions of tons of silicon would be on a very kind of fragile ecology. They could end up in the sea. They could end up in the food chain. And that's one of the big drawbacks. Are we replacing one climate disaster with another? Is it just a lesser evil? Because we simply don't know what impact that will have.
So far, I'm not seeing the silver lining of any of these approaches.
Well, silver lining means you're looking in the right place, because maybe the answer actually is the clouds. In the 1990s, a climatologist called John Latham started looking at something called the Toomey effect.
Toomey?
No, not to you.
Oh.
To me. To me. that the amount of solar radiation that clouds reflect back into space is dependent on the density of the water droplets inside them, and that this is a much underappreciated vehicle for climate manipulation, because Latham realized that if you were to seed the cloud with more water droplets, then you could actually increase the density, and that would increase the radiation that's reflected back into space. Now, I've kind of simplified this a bit. If you go to the Wikipedia page, it's full of equations. That's kind of where the truth is.
So it's just like a cumulus Dyson sphere now.
Well, I guess you could look at it that way. Yeah, a Dyson sphere in the clouds.
And you'd seed it with planes in the same way Malaysia seeds clouds for rain.
Well, I guess you could, but Latham's work identified a more straightforward method. Ships leave something called tracks. Essentially, the pollutants they pump out form shiny reflective clouds that you can actually see on satellite images.
So we're going to use pollution to solve the problem of pollution?
Well, I did say these were radical solutions, but if you think about it, it makes a certain amount of sense. What Latham wants to do is have ships spray droplets of salt water into the lower atmosphere to seed these dense cloud forms.
It sounds like we're back to the windmills.
Well, it would be, but Stephen Salter, an engineer at the University of Edinburgh, has actually done a lot of groundwork. He's come up with systems for drone ships that will spray this very fine mist into the atmosphere. He's gone as far as presenting his work to the British government in 2017. Unsurprisingly, as the UK government is currently in such a tailspin, its members are probably struggling to decide what cereal to eat in the morning, or if it's even worth getting out of bed at all.
So it's money that's holding them up.
Of course, money is the issue, but Salter makes a surprising comparison in his comments to Rowan Hooper in The New Scientist. Unlike the $500 billion for windmills and pump stations, Salter could have a pilot program underway, run his trials and a fleet of ships for 2 years, and actually start to undo some of the damage for the cost of the Brazilian soccer player Neymar.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Apparently, Neymar sold to Paris Saint-Germain, because I know nothing about football, he sold for £198 million back in 2017.
So you want to sell him to pay for climate experiments. I know you said radical, but isn't that kind of slavery?
I think Salter was trying to make a point. I think the point is that $200 million may sound like a lot of money, but sports teams pay that kind of cash. Especially in the US, they'll pay more to transfer individual players, and that we could potentially mitigate some of the Arctic melt for the cost of one soccer star. I don't think anyone is actually advocating bundling him up and selling bits of him off.
So what kind of results are we likely to see?
Genuinely, we don't know. At the moment, there's almost no funding into this type of reflective research. An alliance of scientists is trying to change that. So the Marine Cloud Brightening Project is trying to raise money and awareness for this approach. It's especially cogent because we don't fully understand the relationship between cloud patterns and climate change. For example, it's possible that cloud cover could initially decrease as we reduce atmospheric pollutants, leading actually to further warming spikes because we're reducing the release of the aerosol particles that are forming clouds, much like the tracks that ships leave.
So is that a reason to do it or to shy away from it?
I mean, definitely to do it, because this and other related research will start to map out that relationship in much greater detail. And that will help to make climate mapping forecasts a lot more accurate. And the inaccuracies in the current mapping models are also part of the fire that fuels the climate change deniers. They say that there's too much speculation and that things aren't turning out the way the worst case scenarios forecast.
And your answer to that would be?
The MSP is all about the worst case scenarios. You know, some scientists are already arguing that we've gone past the tipping point. We're past the point that anything we do will undo or rein in the climate apocalypse that they fear is coming. Now, I don't know if that's true. I'd like to believe that it isn't. But we can't base the future around what people like me believe. We have to base it on the science and the predictions of experts, not on the pronouncements of someone who wanders out of his executive office and says, oh, it's snowing. Climate change has to be bunk. Otherwise, we're going to end up at a point where we'll be painting every plant, every animal, and every surface on the planet, including ourselves, a dazzling reflective shade of white. And white is not my color.
There you go. As Indonesia and the Amazon rainforest burn and the Arctic melts, it's time to rephrase the Arctic. You can find all the transcripts of the show on culturepop.com. We'll be right back with Geek Squawks after this. BFM 89.9.
Tech Talk, made possible by TM1. To learn more, visit tm1.com.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.